Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello there, movie truthers. It's Michael Leader, back here once again with one of these lockdown specials of Truth and Movies. Today, I'm joined by David Jenkins. Hi, David.
Hey there.
And David, we're doing something a little differently. So far, we've had all these cozy conversations with Little White Lies contributors and friends, but we're going almost old school in a way. We're going to cover a new release with an interview. Do you want to say a little bit about what this interview is, who it is, what film we're talking about today?
Yeah, we're covering a filmmaker and a critic and artist and poet who has been around for a fair while on these shores, and I've enjoyed his work over many years. It's Mark Cousins, who many of the old school will have discovered as someone who did intros to movies on Channel 4 on Moviedrome. I think he did Moviedrome after Alex Cox, I believe, and then he did this great book called Story of Film, which was his kind of alternative film history. And I think one of the things that he's always tried to do as a critic is offer a kind of counterpoint or counter narrative to traditional modes of looking at film and film history. And he has sort of later in his career, sort of more recently, he's moved into film, and he's this very kind of industrious filmmaker now, has made, you know, pretty much has made a film a year for the last kind of 10 years or so. And they're a mixture of essay films and quite sort of like, you know, looking at architecture and film history and archiving movies and that side of things. And it's very kind of global outlook on things. And this latest project that he's got, I think, is maybe one of his the best things he's ever done. It's called Women Make Film. And it's a kind of, let me just confirm how many chapters it is, because it is a lot. It's a 40 chapter epic series running to 14 hours, so each chapter runs maybe about sort of 15-20 minutes, and it is a kind of, it's basically a celebration of women filmmakers, but in not overtly hyperbolic in that way. What it is that there is a little preamble at the beginning of each episode narrated by Tilda Swinton, which says, you know, all the classics of cinema are made by men. You know, you look at the big canonical titles, and it's men, it's Hitchcock, it's Hawks, it's Jean-Luc Godard. And his kind of brief for this that he sort of set himself is, what if there was an what if we looked at cinema history through films only made by women? And so what we have is it is very much allied to that idea of the kind of, you know, DIY film school. So, you know, it's not like let's look at this director and look at her life and what she did. It's basically saying, let's look at how openings are depicted on film, and here are 10 examples of great openings in films all made by women directors, and how are traveling shots made in films, and how is death depicted in films, and how is the idea of discovery depicted in films. So it's these very kind of primal concepts, and the film all just brings them together very simply with a narrate, like various people narrating, Tilda Swinton, and you've got Jane Fonda in there as well, and Kerry Fox, and Sharmila Tagore, who's like a big Bollywood actress. Really amazing narrations from everyone who like they really kind of invest themselves. I mean, Jane Fonda narrating about, you know, quite obscure Eastern European art house directors is really quite something of a revelation. So I spoke with Mark over the Skype, asked him a few questions about this kind of epic undertaking, and he was glad to answer them. His laptop did crash a couple of times during the recording, but I think we've tried to kind of paste over that with the magic of editing. So hopefully you won't notice too much,
and you'll be just whisked away by Mark Cousins' wonderful voice.
Indeed. Enjoy that as well.
Let's have a listen to your interview with Mark.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Well, Mark, thanks so much again for taking time out to chat to us about your film, Women Make Film.
You're welcome.
Congratulations on it. It is like, it's been a joy to watch. It's a very addictive film to watch. I found myself diving into it and just doing a kind of, I'll just do one more chapter, just one more chapter. And then I just kept going. I think the first question is about the first film that you feature, which is this film called We Were Young.
Yes.
A Bulgarian film.
Yes.
And I'd love to know, could you just tell us, it must have been a big decision to choose to start on that film, this 14-hour road movie.
Yeah. When you make a film, you can either float in the way David Lynch likes you to, or you can plunge in. And I like to plunge in sometimes. And I thought, start with a film clip that is visually exciting. And as you know, it's two torchlights that meet at night during World War II. Visually exciting, but also by a filmmaker who isn't well known. If I had started with Jane Campion or Agnes Varda or Catherine Bigelow, people might have thought, okay, here we go, same old, same old. But if I started with a brilliant scene, which is also by a less well-known filmmaker, I might capture your attention, hopefully.
I see. And can you tell us just a bit of the story about how you came across that film? I mean, is this a film that you discovered from your research into making this, or is this something you've known about for a long time?
I'd known about Binka Zelyazkova for a long time, but I'd seen very few of her films. One of her films has been on YouTube for some years. It's called The Inflated Balloon. It's got various titles, but that's roughly it. And I'd seen that, David, and I thought it was fantastically good. You know, funny and visually daring, touches of Fellini, etc. So I could tell she was very good. But some of the rest of her work was very hard to see. So I got the email address of the Bulgarian Film Archive and emailed the woman. There's a director, a woman called Antonia. I can't remember her second name. And I told her what I was doing. I told her how much I admired Zhelyazkova. There's also a short documentary about her on YouTube. And within a few weeks, a package of Blu-rays came. And the archive had very nicely, very copied a lot of her films for me. And that's sort of gold dust, you know, that's the best Christmas present you can get. And you watch her films and she realized she had this fantastic career, bold, daring, visually gutsy, baroque, you know, not nibbling at cinema, but chomping at it. And that excited me.
You must, when that happens, you must sort of ask yourself the same sort of refrain must be going through your head when you're thinking, why isn't this director well known? Why isn't she out on the Criterion Collection? And why isn't she part of this wider conversation? I mean, did that happen a lot through this process?
Yeah, and you know, you come across the same answers, and you know, those of us who've been interested in films directed by women have been coming across the same answers for decades, as you know, the usual ones that the critics are men, etc. In addition, if you're dealing with a filmmaker who came from the former Soviet bloc, as she did, then there's a sort of political sequestration as well. Some of her films had leftist messages. Now, she was against the state in many ways, but some of her films had leftist messages. And even despite the wonderful liberalism of the kind of artsy cultural world in cinema, nonetheless, it didn't respond well to some Soviet era messages. And I think she was tarred with that brush. But also, you know, the idea of the auteur back in the 60s when she was working was really quite male. It was Fellini and it was Bergman and it was men who were looking into male angst and the big sort of traditional philosophical questions. And so if you didn't fit, you didn't fit. And Binka Zhelyazkova didn't fit.
Can I ask, on that idea of the auteur, I mean, this series is focused on the idea of directors,
yes,
and the sort of director as the creative godhead of the project. Is this something that is you believe in? Is this something that you applied to the project? What was the decision to focus on the director?
Well, yes, as you mentioned, in Women Make Film, I don't look much at... I think of directors as visual thinkers, and that's the theme. Like, how did these women think visually? Hence, there's nothing about music and there's nothing about, you know, sound design, for example, because the director seldom did the music and seldom did the sound design. So I wanted to focus on visual thinking because that's the bit that I understand most. As a filmmaker, you know, that's the bit that is the most exciting. That's what filmmakers talk about in a way, you know. There's all the other brilliant stuff as well. I'm frankly more moved by the sound and music in film, but I'm not a musician, I'm not a sound designer, I'm a filmmaker. And so what I try to stick to what I know, and that's filming. And the director's still the central figure in a film, and therefore I don't make any apology for starting with that. You know, you could make another film about the great screenwriters or the great editors or the great sound designers who are women.
Can I ask, in this process of making this film, what were some of the biggest revelations for you in terms of discovery? Because, I mean, there's so much in this series that feels completely new, and that you're just this is a process of your discovery at the same time.
Yeah. There were loads of individual filmmakers. I hadn't seen Caroline Leaf's animations, the beautiful Canadian animations. I had seen some of Astrid Henning-Jensen's films, but not her best. I'd only seen one Kinyo Tanaka film. And as you know, she was a great actor on Ozu and Mitsuguchi and all those classic Japanese films. But I didn't realize that she was as good a director as she was an actor. And so some names were entirely new to me, but in most instances I'd seen some of these filmmakers' work, and I sort of haughtily assumed that if I had seen them, the best ones of their work would have arrived on our shores or into my mind. And of course that's not true. The very best of these filmmakers' work often was hardly available at all. Lots of discoveries, a real sense of discovery. And on that point also, I would say that I've always been more interested in what I don't know than what I do. You know, I've never been one of those movie fans who just watches the same films all the time. The same 500 films becomes your comfort zone, your harbour. I've always been far more interested in what I don't know, in my own ignorance. In other words, I am what I'm not, in a way.
Mm-hmm. And were there any, like... were there any subjects or were there any films that in the kind of process of making this, you that they were kind of just completely inaccessible to you? Or do you, you know, if you're having explored this area and these filmmakers, was there anything that just eluded you?
Yes. I mean, as you know, David, in silent cinema, most of silent cinema is lost. So there are great films directed by women from the silent era, which we cannot see. You know, hopefully they might turn up in some archive in Siberia or something, but we don't know. Beyond that, I have a very good producer in Glasgow, hopscotch producer John Archer and Clara Glynn, and they were able to get me a lot of stuff, you know, by whatever means, by what means, I don't know. I think that some kind of mafia strong arming goes on, but it also helps, David, that I have made things like The Story of Film, which was shown very widely in many countries, and therefore I have got a bit of a reputation as someone who can not only look into a film, but if I use some clips of a film, it might get widely seen. And that's attractive to somebody who has a print of something or owns the material or owns a master tape or something. So I think I've built some kind of trust in the sort of archive community, and that helps too.
One of the things that is very striking from a visual perspective, I mean, I had to watch this on a computer because obviously it's not available to see on a screen at this moment. What's striking is like you watch a lot of documentaries now that contain archive footage of old films, and often, you know, not often, but very occasionally you see like rips from YouTube that are very low grade and very sort of pixelated and blocky. And we're seeing all these, you know, extremely rare films, and the quality is just pristine in you know, most if not all cases. And it's like that for me was one of the things that felt really incredible about this film, that you've kind of gone through so much care and attention of actually sourcing high quality archive material. And that must have
just been producers, yes.
Nightmarish.
I think they worked very, very hard, you know, and this is being released in Blu-ray, for example, and so we knew that we would be exposed if we used low quality material. I would say, as a matter of principle, I will put a film in even if we can't get a good source copy for it, David, because it's better to show the audience, here's something great, but we can't find a good copy of it. For example, Ana Mariscal's film, El Camino, the Spanish film, we couldn't get a good copy of that, but we put it in as well to remind people, or to put her name on the list. Ana Mariscal, a great movie star who turned director. And even people in Spain, I was in the Cinematheque in Madrid recently, and even they hadn't seen the films that she had directed. So that's an example of low quality footage, maybe even from YouTube, but it's better to put it in as a place marker, as a sort of jacuzzi to the film world. Look at this great director, and look, we can't find a good copy.
Would it be fair to refer to this as a counter history? Is that too kind of negative a thinking about what it is you're doing here? Because it feels more like, I mean, it feels a bit like that.
I think that's pretty good. I would be happy with that. It's a mad, it's like pushing the conventional history to one side. You know, imagine if this film sort of walking along the catwalk and elbowing other film histories out of the way and say, look at me, look at this, look what I am. You know, it's something like that. It's certainly an affirmative work. It's born out of anger, but also love of cinema. And yeah, hopefully you can feel that. And yes, it is trying to blame all of us, you know, including me and you and everybody in the culture for not knowing this material. And it's not trying to make us feel guilty that we didn't know this stuff, but it's sort of saying, look, it's available, it can be seen. And definitely it's a counter-cultural thing. It's in the form as well as the content. The content is a counter-history, but hopefully I think the way that the film's made is a bit unconventional as well.
And it's a counter narrative on kind of two levels in a way, because it is showing us these women artists who we may not be a party to, but then at the same time, and this is something that you're kind of well known for throughout your film and writing work, is that we're seeing geographically diverse and a real effort to not focus on the kind of hegemony of Hollywood, but actually the art that is, you know, the art as a very global thing. Where does that impulse come from?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think that I come from a very small part of the world, Northern Ireland, but I've travelled a lot. And one of the big things that I did in my life is drive from here, where I'm sitting now, Edinburgh, to India. It took sort of 5 months. And when you do big drives around the world or big walks around the world, you start to feel that nowhere is the centre. You get a sort of, you know, you think about somebody like Copernicus, who asked the simple question, what if we are not the centre? What if Hollywood is not the centre of cinema? What if the triangle isn't LA, London, Paris? And it sort of isn't, you know, and particularly in cinema, which is such a global language, it's almost a cliche to say that. But from the times of Chaplin, you know, we had films that were being seen everywhere. I think the sort of implicitly, quietly political aspect of that is that lots of countries now have leaders who are emphasizing national difference and national exceptionalism, etc. And so it's a good time to say, look, this is a global story. Cinema is a single cinema lovers are a single global tribe, as it were, you know. And so even though, you know, I wasn't brought up in Japan, even though I wasn't brought up in Iran, there's something about their cinema which is mine. And that's kind of rejuvenating, I think.
Do you feel that you have you've changed the way you watch films? With when you're watching a film with, say, the mindset of actually making a bigger project like this, do you find you're watching the films in a different way, like you're enjoying them and you're being more kind of forcefully analytical and objective about them, or can you watch a film for a project like this and just think that was an absolute rip snorter and I just want to watch it again, you know?
Yeah, I know what you mean. If I've got a project in mind, if there's a specific thing I'm doing, then I guess, yeah, your mind scans the film looking for that particular thing. You know, let's say if I was making a film about, I don't know, feet. If I watched a film, I would notice the feet scenes, for example. But more generally, I haven't changed much. I've been watching films for 45 years now, and I started clearly watching as a boy, and I wasn't a filmmaker. I didn't think I would become one, but 45 years later, I still feel watch mostly in a unfiltered, childlike way, I think, you know, as open as possible to the, you know, the kind of imaginative plenitude of the film, or the simple joy, or the fun, or the musicality, or whatever. And then as soon as the film finishes, I find that my adult brain kicks in and is trying to work out why I liked it or what was fun about it. And yeah, and I think that's a good way to watch. It means that you don't become snobby, you know, and I really don't like snobby film people. Or I like them, but I don't like their taste, you know, just to be clear. And so when a film like Cats came along at the end of last year, I watched it and I had an amazing time in the cinema, you know, and then I had to work out why. So yeah, I think I still watch films similar to the way I do, even though I'm a filmmaker now, and even though some of my films are about,
I guess,
cinema.
With a film like Cats, it feels so different to everything else that when you've seen so much, it almost becomes a piece of a wider puzzle.
Yeah, I think so. And Cats felt to me like, you know, filmmakers have mood boards where you stick loads of things on a physical board or in an edit to say it should feel something like this. And those things aren't expected to fit together or cohere. And Cats felt like the most expensive mood board in movie history.
That's. I think Tom Hooper would be pleased with that. So one of the things that I have also watched is a little sort of, I guess, a little additional documentary that you have made as part of the Blu-ray, which kind of explains some of the process.
Oh, yes.
And some of your thinking behind,
yes,
the creation of the film. And one of the aspects of it that is that seemed quite shocking to me is that you said that you worked on the film for quite a long time without any remuneration. And
yes,
yeah.
Remuneration. Yeah, that's true.
That seems mad. I mean, what were your feelings for the reason behind that?
Well, you know, there are good and bad aspects of that. We tried to get some money for this film, but people didn't want to give us much. And my producers are pretty brave, and they thought, we'll just do it anyway. We'll stop. You can spend a lot of time with the begging bowl, you know, waiting for the green light. But you realize that the green light might not come, or if it does come, it comes with loads of conditions. So if we had had funding from, say, a TV company for this, they probably would have said 14 hours is way too long. They might have said things like, we haven't heard of many of these filmmakers. Could you focus more on the more famous ones? Or they might have wanted us to focus more on Hollywood. There are loads of conventional ways of doing this, talking about making it a story of victimization, for example, or a chronological story. And so the fact that we got not a penny of funding, of external funding, for years and years and years meant that we were free to do it our way. When the film was first announced, some people said, oh, who commissioned this? You know, and I was just sitting here laughing, having been 3 years in at this point. Nobody commissioned it. And, you know, that might be, you know, people who don't know the film world very well think that you just don't do anything until somebody gives you a big pot of money and then you live a sort of fancy lifestyle and make your film. But that's certainly not the way I work. You know, I've got a very simple lifestyle. So it meant that, you know, we could work without, we paid our editor, our producer, my producers paid the editor properly because you don't want to exploit anybody else. It's okay to self-exploit, but not others. And also you need to have the confidence in the work. And we just plowed on and on and on for years. This is long before Weinstein happened or anything like that. Just in the basic belief that this was valuable, and it was particularly valuable just to look at the work, David, not to tell the stories of the lives of the filmmakers or their industrial difficulties, because that there are better people to do that. And I think it's paid off because this film won't date too much because it's just about the work. It's what people did in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, etc.
Yeah, I mean, it does really baffle me that something like this would, I don't know, it feels so important from the outset that to be able to have that freedom and creativity and the desire to want to actually tell a slightly an off-kilter story or a new kind of view on an often told story, that you'd have to sort of take that route. And I don't know, it seems maybe that if that could be a kind of wider story for a lot of more independent minded and creative art, really, which is sad.
Yeah, and I think if you work really, really cheaply, you know, I mean, I've been filming, I take my camera everywhere, I've been filming for decades, and so I've got thousands of shots on my computer. So it means that you make something like this, if you want driving shots, and as you know, there are lots of driving shots, quite a few of them were on my computer, or my producers at SAM, and we bought some in. So didn't have to do much actual physical travel for this one, so it was made relatively cheaply. And again, when you work on low budgets, you, as a consequence of that, you buy your intellectual liberty and your creative liberty. And so it paid off well, and this film has sold all around the world more than anything I've ever done. And American TV is going to go really big with it. It's already had a big impact in Brazil, and Finnish TV bought, I think, scores, if not 100 films directed by women to play with it, you know. And so lots of India, China, Russia, etc. UK still hasn't bought it for TV, but we are in a particular moment in the UK where, you know, because of Brexit, etc., where we're quite inward looking in some ways, I think.
Yeah, no, you're right. That's kind of tragic. I hope people do see it. And I wondered, I guess, final question then, like, while you were doing this, you make lots of movies. Were you making other movies at the same time as you were making this?
Yes, I was, you know. I love working, you know. I love the energizing effect of trying to be creative and think up particularly questions of form. What's the shape of the film? That's my central excitement, you know. And so yes, I've finished another film about the great film producer Jeremy Thomas, which will be coming available soon, we hope, depending on what happens after lockdown. And I've been working at the same time on two other films, which I shouldn't say anything about. Okay. Just yet.
No, that's good to have that secrecy. I was wondering, will you ever, like, because a lot of the films you make are, you make documentaries and you make, I guess you'd call them like sort of poetic essay films as well. And I wondered, is there ever been a desire to go into the kind of full bore fiction on a set with big collaboration with other people film movie?
I mean, I've done some of that, as I'm sure you know. I made a film called I Am Belfast, and some of the scenes in that had, you know, a crew of 30 and extras, I think of 60, you know, and big technology. And I made what I think is a fully fictional film, Stockholm My Love, with Nina Cherry, for example. So, and the very first short films that I did in my early 20s had actors and scripts and things. So I have done some of that, but it's the grey area. It's the sort of, it's the overlap between fiction and documentary, you know, the sorts of documentary that aren't reportage, for example, or aren't sociology, or aren't news. As you rightly say, the bits of documentary that shade into a slightly more poetic area, that's what really fires my imagination.
And here's something, a crazy question, which I think I probably know the answer to, but would you, if you got someone like a Hollywood producer knocking down your door saying, would you make this movie for us? Do you have interest in becoming a, you know, could you be a director for hire?
I've been offered quite a few times, you know, sort of more conventional, bigger budget films, you know, and I just said no, because I know a lot of filmmakers and I've sat with filmmakers who did the Hollywood thing. And they are, you know, shadows of their former selves, you know. And I want to be making a lot. And I want to concentrate on the creative process as much as possible. And I don't want to spend years in development hell and post-production hell and marketing hell. So I've been offered really very large sums of money to direct, but I've said a very polite no.
Wow. Wow. Mark, thank you so much. Congratulations again on the film. I hope as many people as possible see it, go out and buy the Blu-ray. So it's available on Blu-ray and it's going to be on the BFI player
streaming,
as well.
Streaming on BFI player, yes. And then it'll come, as you can imagine, onto the bigger stream. It'll be able to be streamed in more conventional ways quite soon.
And on TV soon, I'm sure.
Fingers crossed.
Yes. Well, thanks so much, Mark. Have a lovely rest of day.
It's lovely talking to you, David. Enjoy your day.
See ya. Thank you.
Bye.
So that was David talking with Mark Cousins about his new release, Women Make Film. David, is that out now or coming out soon?
I think by the time you hear this podcast, it should be out on BFI Player. And as I mentioned in the interview, yeah, it's probably going to be on other platforms fairly soon after that. So it should be widely available.
Is it a bingeable thing? Watch it all in one?
Oh, big time, big time. I mean, I think I watched it in about 4 3-hour chunks, and it's very kind of, it's very therapeutic. It's very like, you know, I think one of the great things about it is that he very rarely uses the same, like the same films appear occasionally, but not very often. So like, with each little chapter, you're making like two or three quite sort of major discoveries or at least when you're watching the films, you feel like you just there are so many instances where you think, I absolutely have to see this in some way. And a lot of them are very, probably extremely tough to track down. So, you know, as we said, I mean, you hope that something like this will act as a kind of first port of call for other maybe distributors or you know, Blu-ray labels or, you know, streaming channels to actually kind of pluck these films out of obscurity. But I know that there are a host of films playing alongside this as a kind of curated extra, so there will be wonderful opportunities for people to watch, to sort of dive in, do a bit of deep dive outwards.
I remember he did that around his documentary The Story of Children and Film.
Yeah,
there was a whole touring program with some of the great deep cuts in that. I think that's one of the best things about his work, isn't it, that you see the doc but then often these other films are unearthed alongside them.
Yeah.
Oh, terrific.
I think, yeah, he's definitely like, you know, he's, I think there is so much advocacy in his work, and it's never done in a kind of, in a way that's like, it's very earnest the way it's done. And I don't mean that in a negative way. It's not earnest. It's very sincere. Mm-hmm. The way he kind of advocates for cinema. And, you know, I think we should not look at what he's doing as in any kind of cynical way.
Right. It's interesting what he says about getting scripts to make other films. Who's approaching Mark Cousins to make movies? Was he in the running to make Venom 2?
I think when you've proven yourself to be able to make movies and get behind cameras and you know, work with actors, and you know, as he says, he has made things like on a bigger scale before, and you know, in his youth he's made like shorts, and so you know, he does have the sort of technical know-how. So you know, people that's rare, and people need that. And he's a man with a vision.
Yeah, I think that's something to put to the listeners. Listeners, let us know at the usual channels what projects you would put to Mark Cousins to take on next. That would be at Truth and Movies on Twitter, truthandmovies@tcolondon.com. But there's also the comments section at ldrealize.com/podcast. David, thank you so much for talking with me today and also for bringing us this interview.
No worries.
I'm Michael Eder, and as always, this has been a 7 Digital production.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.